driven by sales. And if you didn't sell drugs illegally, you were not seen as a team player. The Grassley Initiative is championed by a diverse array of watchdog groups over government waste. Taxpayers Against Fraud, the National Whistleblower Center, the Project on Government Oversight, and the Government Accountability Project are among the group officially supporting the update to the anti-fraud law. But advocates have expressed confusion over the involvement of several other supposed taxpayer protection organizations. Citizens Against Government Waste and Americans for Tax Reform, two conservative groups that do not disclose donor information, filed a letter to lawmakers urging them to vote down the Grassley measure. Despite Citizens Against Government Waste's official focus on fighting government waste, the very intent of the False Claims Act, the group's lobbying arm argued in a letter that the bill was not appropriate for inclusion in the infrastructure package because it is not related to traditional infrastructure, and the bill is not fully understood by the 95 senators who have not co-sponsored the legislation. Americans for Tax Reform similarly argued that the legislation had not received proper debate. Neither Citizens Against Government Waste nor Americans for Tax Reform responded to requests for comments explaining why they have lobbied so aggressively against taxpayer protection legislation and whether any donor interests are involved.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, compassion to others. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the compassion to others. In Islamic lifestyle, it is very important to have the compassion and being compassionate, and also we can say like being merciful towards other. This compassion to the others, like, you know, in the Islamic texts also, it is said to have the rahmah, or this compassion towards the orphans, towards the masakin, those who are needy, towards the poor, towards those who are in your household. So this compassioning, having this compassion towards others, is one of the important parts of the Islamic lifestyle. We should not just love ourselves. We should not have just this compassion towards ourselves. Rather, we need to have this towards others. So therefore, this sacrifice that we give with this compassion, that we have compassion towards others, and we look towards and we take care of the rights of the others, this is very important, which cannot be found in the Western lifestyle. It is only in the Islamic lifestyle. In the Islamic lifestyle, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala emphasizes. Why? Because He is Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. He is the compassionate. He is the beneficial. He is merciful. So therefore, when He Himself is merciful, when He Himself is compassionate, therefore He also asks us to be compassionate. In the social life, a mu'min, or the mu'mineen, the believers, in Islamic lifestyle, must be compassionate. And this compassion should be towards all. It shouldn't be only towards those who have money, those who have some kind of rank or status, those who are our closer, we can say, like people. It should be towards all. If we see an orphan who do not have anything, if we see a needy person, if we see a poor person, the compassionate, this compassion should be towards them as well. The sympathy that we need to have, obviously just having compassion and sympathy in the hearts is not something that will take us near them. We need to have something more than that, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of compassion towards others, and we said that in Islam, Allah has emphasized on this compassion, and this is the main part of the Islamic lifestyle, that when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle, we should have compassion towards the others. And it should not be only towards the rich people or those who we love, but also the other people or other parts of the society as well. So this compassion should be towards others as well. Why? Because we need to have a good society. We want an Islamic society. And the main point is that in this compassion, it is not important to have this in your heart only. Someone might say that, yes, in my heart I have compassion towards others and merciful towards others. No. This sympathy, this compassion should be shown through actions, and that is important. That is important when we look at an orphan, when we look at a needy person, when we look at a poor person, when we look at someone who is in our society, in our neighborhood, do we practically show our compassion towards them or not? Do we practically show our sympathy towards them or not? You know, this mercy, this sympathy for them, and having compassion towards them, helping them out when they need our help, and think about themselves the way we think about ourselves. You know, in Islam it is said that when you want to buy something and when you are about to give a gift to your brother, give what you like and do not give him something which you do not need or you do not like. Generally, when we do charities, unfortunately, the things that are overthrown and we just kept them on a side of our house and we want to throw them, we give such things to the charities. Whereas charity means that you give them the good thing, the things that you like, you do charity from those, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. Prosecutors are among the most powerful players in the criminal justice system. They can send a defendant off to years in prison or even to death row. Most wield this power honorably. Yet when prosecutors don't, they rarely pay a price, even for repeated and egregious misconduct that puts innocent people behind bars. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, Who Will Hold Prosecutors Accountable? Right. Prosecutors are among the most powerful players in the criminal justice system. They can send a defendant off to years in prison or even to death row. Most wield this power honorably. Yet when prosecutors don't, they rarely pay a price, even for repeated and egregious misconduct that puts innocent people behind bars. But why? Because they're protected by layers of silence and secrecy that are written into local, state, and federal policy, shielding them from any real accountability for wrongdoing. New York City offers a prime example of a problem endemic to the nation. Consider the city's official reaction to the barrelful of misconduct in Queens that a group of law professors recently brought to light. As the New York Times reported last month, the professors filed grievances against 21 prosecutors in the borough for everything from lying in open court to withholding key evidence from the defense, and then posted those grievances to a public website. These weren't close calls. In every instance, an appeals court had made a finding of prosecutorial misconduct. In many cases, the misconduct was so severe that it required overturning a guilty verdict and releasing someone from prison. Three men wrongfully convicted of a 1996 murder were exonerated after 24 years behind bars. But that rectified only the most glaring injustice. To date, none of the prosecutors have faced any public consequences. Some are still working. How did New York City respond to this litany of widespread misconduct by its own agents? It went after the professors who publicized it. In a letter to the committee that handles misconduct charges, New York City's top lawyer, known as the Corporation Counsel, accused the law professors of abusing the grievance process to promote a political agenda and of violating a state law that requires formal complaints about lawyers' conduct to be kept secret unless judicial authorities decide otherwise. And they virtually never do. The grievance committee agreed to punish the professors by denying them access to any future updates on their complaints, even though state law requires that complainants be kept informed throughout the process. The upshot is that the committee could dismiss the complaints tomorrow and no one would know. For good measure, the Corporation Counsel then sought to keep secret the letter requesting the law professors be punished for violating the secrecy law. This isn't just shooting the messenger, it's tossing the gun into the East River and threatening anyone who tries to fish it out. We know about all this because the law professors sued the city in federal court, claiming that the secrecy law infringes on the First Amendment. How could it not? If someone tells a New York Times reporter about a prosecutor's misconduct, the reporter is free to write a story addressing those allegations for all the world to see. But if the same person files a formal grievance about the same misconduct with the state, she is barred from talking about it. It's not even clear what the punishment for violating the law would be, as evidenced by the fact that dozens of prominent lawyers, including former New York judges and even prosecutors, went public with grievances they filed against Rudy Giuliani over his role in Donald Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 presidential election and encourage the 6th of January riot at the Capitol. To date, none of these lawyers have faced public sanctions for speaking to the press. In theory, the secrecy law exists to protect lawyers from being smeared by frivolous complaints. But that rationale makes no sense when applied to prosecutors, who are public officials doing the state's work. In the Queen's cases, their misconduct is already a matter of public record. Even if it weren't, there is no principled reason to prevent the public airing of complaints, not to mention public hearings against officials who have the power to send people to prison. Certainly, the defendants they face off against in courts of law don't enjoy such privileges. New York shelters its lawyers from disciplinary measures more than most states in the country, even as it ranks near the top in total number of exonerations, a majority of which are the result of misconduct by prosecutors. Meanwhile, the few attempts to increase oversight of New York prosecutors have been stymied. A 2018 law established a commission specifically to deal with prosecutorial misconduct in a more independent and transparent way. But the State District Attorneys Association challenged it, and a court struck it down as unconstitutional. Lawmakers designed a new commission this year, but it appears that no commissioners have yet been appointed to it. New York's prosecutor protection racket is, alas, far from unique. In Washington, the U.S. Justice Department aggressively shields its own prosecutors from outside accountability thanks to a 1988 law that lets the agency essentially police itself. All other federal agencies and even parts of the U.S. Justice Department, like the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, are subject to oversight by independent inspectors general, who conduct thorough investigations and issue lengthy reports with their findings. Federal prosecutors skate by on an internal review process that is run out of the Office of Professional Responsibility, whose head is appointed by and reports directly to the Attorney General. The office almost never makes its findings public, and when it does, it often provides only a brief summary months after the fact. In the words of one legal ethics expert, it's a black hole. By contrast, the Inspector General's Office of the Justice Department just released its semi-annual report, as it is required to do by law, detailing the 52 reports it issued between April and September of this year, as well as the closing of investigations that resulted in 68 convictions or guilty pleas and 66 firings, resignations, or disciplinary actions. The level of scrutiny that federal prosecutors are subject to matters so much because they're just as prone to misconduct as their state and local counterparts. Take the botched prosecution of former Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska on corruption charges, or the legal green light Justice Department lawyers gave interrogators to torture terrorism suspects, or the more recent revelation that Jeffrey Epstein got a sweetheart deal in 2008 from his prosecutor Alex Acosta, who later became Labor Secretary in the Trump administration. Yet, in the latter two cases, the Office of Professional Responsibility found no misconduct. Alex Acosta was guilty only of poor judgment, the Office of Professional Responsibility said. In the Senator Ted Stevens case, the office found misconduct but said it was unintentional, and it let the prosecutors off with a slap on the wrist. Have there been other similarly egregious failures to hold prosecutors to account? Almost certainly, but we don't know because the U.S. Justice Department doesn't tell us. There is no principled reason for federal prosecutors to avoid the accountability expected of all public servants. Their exemption from the general rule was adopted in 1988 as a favor to Dick Thornburgh. who was then the Attorney General and had tried to derail the creation of an Inspector General for the U.S. Justice Department. Years later, Mr. Thornburg admitted he had been wrong. "This is a highly professional operation that goes where the evidence leads and is not directed by the way the political winds are blowing," he said at a gathering marking the law's 25th anniversary in 2014. "I've come to be a true believer," he said. So have large numbers of Republicans and Democrats in Congress, a remarkable fact at the moment when the parties can't agree on the time of day. Their fix is straightforward. Eliminate the loophole in the 1988 law and empower the Inspector General to review claims against federal prosecutors, just as the office currently does in cases involving other Justice Department employees. A Senate bill co-sponsored by Mike Lee, Republican Senator of Utah, and Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, would do exactly this. Yet Attorney General Merrick Garland is continuing in the tradition of his predecessors by opposing any change to the existing system. "Prosecutors can work in the interests of fairness and justice, but they can also cheat and destroy people's lives. They should be held accountable when they do that, both to vindicate their victims and to help ensure that they can't do it again."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha. And we are discussing the 87th sermon, which deals with the position of the communities and the situation of the communities before the coming of Islam and what Islam did to these communities. And this is going to give us an insight as to how Islam can give a solution to the problems that the world is facing today. One of those situations that Imam Ali alayhi salam explains and talks about in this sermon is where he says, وشعارها الخوف ودثارها السيف. Imam Ali alayhi salam says that the communities at that time, their shi'ar, that means their vest, their undercloth, was fear. Shi'aruha al-khawf. That means these communities had something they were hiding under their shirts, and that was fear. And fear is something that was common, that every individual in that society had, be it the Roman Empire, be it the Persian Empire, be it the people that were living in the Arabian Peninsula. This was something common, this was something that was actually something that also could be one of the reasons why the communities had leadership, because the leadership there unfortunately was something that was thriving on fear. So the word says, وَشِعَارُهَا الْخَوْفِ.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when you talk about, when we sat and in the starting of this session, we said, وَشِعَارُهَا الْخَوْفِ. The communities at that time, they had a shi'ar, and that underclothing or the vest, their vest was fear. Whoever you turned to, whoever you looked at in those communities, they were afraid of something. Okay? When you looked at them, when you came close to them, they were afraid of something. Some people are afraid of being clobbered by the club or being whipped and lashed. They were afraid of the tax collectors coming to collect their taxes, or by the evil dictator trying to steal something from them, steal their land or steal their people, their women and children. Another one was afraid of the sword, afraid of the weapons, afraid of war. One was fearing to lose his wealth and money. Another one was afraid of losing his position. Another one is afraid of becoming poor. And yet another would be afraid of being alone and left alone in the community. Everyone had one fear or the other. Even those that were in power were afraid. And what were they afraid of? They were afraid of losing their power. So there was always this fear that existed in the communities. Those who are under authority, those who are under control of the leaders, they were also afraid of power, but they were afraid of being punished by that power. They were afraid of the oppression from that power. But one who had the power was afraid of losing it. This is something that was common. So such was the fear amongst the people that it was as if they were seeing the angel of death right next to them every time, feeling that something or the other will happen and the situation will change. That is the meaning of شِعَارُهَا الْخَوْفِ, that they had a vest, the community had, they were wearing the vests of fear. And that is what was hidden. The underclothing, the inside clothing of the community was fear. You don't see it from outside, because from outside, as the vest is not seen from outside, the vest is covered by the outer clothing. Similarly, those people who are afraid would not show their fear, but they would express it in other ways.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, We said that the communities, Imam Ali alayhi salam says at that time, the people of the communities at that time, shi'aruha al-khawf, their underclothing, their vest rather, was their inner wear was fear. That means they could not express fear. Rather, the fear was inside them. The fear was within. The fear was not something expressed, not something apparent. But you would see, for example, a people would not perform certain actions out of that fear. So although they would not show that they are afraid, they would not say that I'm worried or I'm afraid, but they would do things that would express that fear. For example, they would not go to a certain place, or they would not buy from a certain shop, or for example, they would give away information about their own very close relatives. This is because of the inner fear that existed amongst the people. This fear is something that was there. And if you look at history, you can see this exact statements are reflecting in those societies. This was what was happening, and this was how the communities were being led, unfortunately. And this is what Imam Ali alayhi salam said, that the thing that fed these systems was dead matter, was what was jifa, was dead matter. And then he goes on to say, wa nitharuha as-saif. Nithar means the external clothing, that means the outer clothing, that which covers the outer layer like a robe. What was that? That was the sword. Whatever you see from outside, whatever catches your eye from outside is that sword, is that military might, it's that physical strength. So you see that those big communities at that time, the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, you can see that outside they would show that grandeur, that military might. That was the external robe. But Imam Ali says the internal, the vest, that the internal cloth that is there, the inner clothing is fear. You can see the outside, you know, a kind of, you know, exploding with power, but inside there is weakness. And this was a time when Islam now comes and shines a light of hope, removes the fear, and tries to control the external, you know, manifestations of false strength. Let us pray to Allah to help us to understand these statements. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new report reveals U.S. military academies remain inundated by institutional racism despite minor gains since proclaiming anti-discrimination policies a decade ago to bring in more racially diverse students. Here we present you an article in this regard written jointly by Aaron Morrison, Helen Wiffering, and Noreen Nasir, titled, Report Says U.S. Military Academies Remain Plagued by Racism. Stay tuned for more. According to an AP report published on Friday, December 3rd, 8 years after he graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, African-American Jeffrey Easterling remains astonished by the Confederate history still memorialized on the storied Academy's campus. The 6-foot-tall painting of Confederate Gen Robert E. Lee in the library, the barracks dormitory named for Lee, and the Lee Gate on Lee Road. He remembers feeling devastated as a black student at the Army Academy when a classmate pointed out that the slave also depicted in the Lee painting. He recalled thinking, as quoted in the report, how did the only black person who got on a wall in this entire human's school, how is it a slave? Easterling later traveled the country as a diversity admissions officer to recruit the students from underrepresented communities to West Point and observed, it was so hard to tell people like, yeah, you can trust the military, and then their kids Google and go, why is there a barracks named after Lee? According to the report, American military academies provide a key pipeline into the leadership of the armed services, and for the better part of the last decade, they have welcomed more racially diverse students each year. However, beyond blanket anti-discrimination policies, these federally funded institutions offer little details about how they screen for extremist or hateful behavior or address the racial slights that some graduates of color say they face daily. Earlier this year, AP published another report in which current and former enlistees and officers in nearly every branch of the armed services described a deep-rooted culture of racism and discrimination that stubbornly festers, despite repeated efforts to eradicate it. Less attention has been paid to the premier institutions that produce a significant portion of the services officer corps. The academies of the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Coast Guard, and U.S. Merchant Marine. According to the report, some graduates of color from top U.S. military schools who endured what they describe as a hostile environment are left questioning the military maxim that all service members wearing the same uniform are equal. That includes Carlton Shelley II, who was recruited to play football for West Point from his Sarasota, Florida high school and entered the academy in 2009. On the field, he described the term as a brotherhood where his skin color didn't matter. But off the field, he said he and other black classmates too often were treated like stereotype of the angry black man. Some students of color have spotlighted what they see as a systematic discrimination at the academies by creating Instagram accounts, Black at West Point, Black at USAFA, and Black at USNA, to relate their personal experiences. The latest annual defense spending bill mandated that the Defense Department survey all its military properties for references or symbols that potentially commemorate the Confederacy, including at West Point, which the commission overseeing the work picked as its first site to visit earlier this year. But the deadline to act on any recommendations is still more than 2 years away. Following the murder of George Floyd in 2020, which sparked global protest, a group of West Point alums released a 40-page letter urging the academy to address major failures in combating intolerance and racism, adding, "We hold fast to the hope that our alma mater will take the necessary steps to champion the values it espouses." Shelley said the academy has significant work to do to retain and support students of color. He said in his class, he estimated about 35 black students graduated, some crazy low number, adding, and we started with a lot of more. Citing 2019 data from the Under Secretary of Defense, the report notes, the academies are a growing pathway to officer status for black cadets. with about 13% of black active duty officers commissioned through the five institutions compared to 19% of white active duty officers. Most students who enroll, nearly 60 to 70%, are nominated by U.S. senators or representatives from their home states as part of a system created in 1840s to build a geographically diverse officer corps. However, today the country's changed demographics mean the system gives disproportionate influence to rural congressional districts that tend to be whiter. According to a March report by the Connecticut Veterans Legal Center, only 6% of nominations to the Army, Air Force, and Naval Academies made by the current members of Congress went to black candidates, even though 15% of the population aged 18 to 24 is black. The report said 8% of congressional nominations went to Hispanic students, though they make up 22% of young adults. The diversity of nominations has improved slightly in the past 25 years, but the report noted that 49 Congress members did not nominate a single black student while in office and 31 nominated no Hispanic candidates. While the number of Hispanic cadets increased in the past two decades at the Coast Guard and Naval Academies, black cadets showed no noticeable increase during that time. In the class of 2000, there were 73 black midshipmen in Naval Academy and just 77 in 2020. At the Coast Guard Academy, there were 15 black cadets in the 2001 class, and in 2021, merely 16. Two of the five academies, West Point and the Air Force Academy, now have their first black leaders. But Sterling, the West Point graduate, noted that the faculty there remains mostly white, meaning students who don't see themselves and don't want to stay can find it hard to ask for help. Greg Elliott said he often found himself in trouble as a midshipman at the Merchant Marine Academy and was asked to leave without graduating. He doesn't blame the academy for his mistakes, and he said he never faced overt racism, but he wonders if a more diverse faculty and student body could have changed his course by making him feel he belonged. He remembers a fellow black alum telling him to just plow through with his head down and realize the academy was a terrible place to be at, but it's a great place to be from. Both Sterling and Shelley said they also saw signs of extremism during their time in the army. Timothy Berry, a former Army field artillery officer who graduated from West Point in 2013 and served as class president, said he never felt comfortable reporting racist incidents while at the academy, fearing it would draw unwanted scrutiny to him not being a perfect cadet, however minor his shortcomings might be. An Inspector General's report last year found the Coast Guard Academy had mishandled nearly a dozen race-based harassment charges between 2013 and 2018, and also noted that harassment was underreported in part because of concerns about negative consequences. Lieutenant Commander Kimberly Young McClear, a black woman who taught at the Academy from 2014 to 2019, said she herself faced years of harassment and retaliation on campus, which she had detailed in congressional testimony. Although the academies play a big role in the diversity of military leadership, some have argued that the pipeline begins even earlier, at the high school level. The Department of Defense sponsors junior ROTC programs at high schools around the country, where students can learn the values of the armed services, run drills, and wear the uniforms. According to a 2017 study sponsored by the Secretary of Defense, the programs are often located at high schools with larger than average populations of students of color. Though it may not be an official recruitment program, Junior ROTC promotes the military branches as a pathway to excellence. Cadets' handbooks for Navy, Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps all stipulate non-discrimination policies with regard to race and gender and emphasize treating everyone with dignity and respect. But former junior ROTC instructor Cardell Anthony Hopkins said little was done after one of his students at Lake Brantley High School in Florida alerted him to social media posts by her fellow cadets making racist comments about Hopkins, a retired black master sergeant.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. The role of the academic elite in making scientific discoveries. This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country.
جوان نخبه ما باید دنبال این باشه خلاقیت در دانش و حالا فرض بفرمایید که مثلا نیروی جاذبه حالا مثال‌های قدیمیش ایناست دیگه از قدیم این مثال‌ها رو می‌زدیم نیروی جاذبه وجود داشت یکی اینو کشف کرد بر اساس او دانش‌هایی به وجود آمد
Our outstanding youth must pursue this creativity in science. For example, there was gravity. These are common old examples that I have been using for a long time. Someone discovered this and science was created based on it. There was the power of electricity in nature, but no one knew about it until someone discovered it. Based on this discovery, this vast field of science and technology was created. The same is true of new sciences such as nanotechnology, stem cells, and nuclear energy. The discovery of a truth in nature, of a tradition, a valuable law, or an element in the nature and science created by God can help you to realize a scientific point. Then that point will become science. Information will be compiled, improved upon, and led to technology and other such things.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
یه نکته دیگری که در باب نخبگان وجود داره، من قبلها هم یه وقتایی به این اشاره کردم، این است که یکی از هدفهای جامعه علمی کشور، نه فقط نخبگان، همه جوامع علمی، البته در مورد نخبگان این بیشتر مورد نیاز هست، این است که باید به مسائل کشور فکر کنن، مسئله محور کار کنن.
Another point about the academic elite, which I have mentioned once before as well, is that one of the goals of the country's scientific community, not just the academic elite, but all the scientific community, should be to think about the issues troubling the country and work in a problem-orientated way.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
If the yellow vests march, but the mainstream media doesn't cover it, does it have an effect? In the age of social media, the answer seems to be an unequivocal yes, perhaps much to the anger of so-called legacy media. Since the yellow vests started their season two, domestic media has been almost completely absent. But for the eighth consecutive Saturday, they marched nationwide, shut down toll booths, and occupied roundabouts. The Yellow Vests say they don't expect fair treatment from France's private media. Less than 10 billionaires control 90% of all the nation's media, with strict control over an editorial policy which many say is often right-wing.
Starting in June 2019, France's mainstream media simply stopped reporting on the Yellow Vests. However, they continued to march nationwide in major numbers through the two-month general strike that winter and until March 2020, when the coronavirus forced a ban on all public demonstrations.
In Paris, one of the Yellow Vest demonstrations gathered outside of government-owned Radio France's headquarters to denounce the failure of public media journalists to provide fair coverage of the nation's biggest social movement in decades.
We pay our taxes to support public media, and we pay to help privately owned media as well. But they both relay the exact same opinions and both exclude and they both slander any dissenting voices. What we're asking for is that the diversity of opinions be respected, and we're telling these journalists to stop their censorship and propaganda.
The ever-increasing concentration of French media ownership has forced the government to act. This week, they quietly authorized a commission to investigate the issue, with results due in early 2022. The conclusions will likely have a lot to say about the true freedom of the French press
during the age of Western corporate domination. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The European Commission's Joint Research Centre says 50 million people in the EU are suffering the effects of so-called energy poverty. It means households are having to prioritise food over heat. EU energy ministers have been meeting in Brussels to assess the crisis.
Since we launched our communication and toolbox on energy prices, 20 member states have taken or announced measures to mitigate the impact on their people and businesses, in particular the most vulnerable.
But that means almost a third of EU governments have not taken any action to protect citizens. Gas and electricity prices are out of control. Civil society organisations are forecasting that energy poverty will be hitting 80 million people in the EU before winter is over. The EU's dysfunctional energy market is currently in a state of flux. The bloc is heavily dependent on Russia's gas. The European Commission confirms Moscow is fulfilling all of its supply contracts. However, energy storage is a problem in the EU. Supplies were depleted last winter due to unusually cold weather. Then there was huge demand when EU nations began lifting COVID-19 restrictions. Energy experts say the EU could benefit if it improved relations with Russia. The 27-country bloc could also push back against US foreign policy so that new supply chains could be utilised, for example, with respect to Iran, which has enormous energy reserves. EU leaders are divided over how to deal with the crisis, but it's clear there are no quick fixes. The matter will be high on their agenda when they meet here in just under 2 weeks' time for a summit on the 16th of December. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following a meeting with the signatories of the nuclear agreement, known as the JCPOA, Iran calls for a reasonable, documented and rational response to its proposals for the removal of US sanctions and Iran's return to full compliance. Deputy Foreign Minister and lead negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani said Britain, France and Germany were not happy with some of Iran's proposals.
They had no complaint about these proposals being irrelevant, but they say they are not consistent with our viewpoints, and I told them this is natural. We are not supposed to express ideas that are in line with your viewpoints. We take our own interests and policies into consideration. The important point is that they are based on principles that all sides agree on. No European side claims that Iran's proposals lack legal basis.
A diplomatic source close to the Iranian negotiating team said the country's proposed drafts were in complete conformity with the JCPOA, adding it was regrettable that some European sides were attempting to dictate their own demands round the negotiating table while failing to acknowledge that a revival of the deal requires compliance by all sides.
I think the current administration, what it is saying is that the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, good or bad, is something that Iran's accepted, and we will commit ourselves to it. However, we will not allow the other side to retain sanctions, maximum pressure sanctions, and then expect us to go back to 2015. That simply won't happen.
EU coordinator Enrico Mora said there were substantial challenges ahead, while time to reach an agreement was not unlimited. While Iran is calling for a rational and documented response to its proposals, European diplomats are expressing concern and scepticism. The Vienna talks are set to resume next week when it may become more clear whether the gaps can be bridged. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
The story of how Palestine was wrenched from the indigenous people lives on. It is passed down from chest to chest, from generation to generation. Even Palestinians born outside their homeland and raised in refugee camps or elsewhere carry the story with them. Attendees at this art exhibition say living in the UK, it's even more important to show up.
I think here in Britain, given Britain's role in creating the situation for Palestinian people and its ongoing support for the Israeli government and allowing it to carry out its apartheid policies, we have a special duty here to raise awareness about the situation, to fight our government when it supplies weapons to the Israeli government and gives it its support.
I support the struggle completely. And I love the forthright strength, the mood of the Palestinian people is